is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. So, do you need something from the grocery store? Maybe some eggs? Some baby carrots? A little Cap'n Crunch, maybe?
Dozen kinds of special cakes. Never seen that before.
Think about your local grocery store for a second. You probably know it like the back of your hand, where you find the milk, or the bread, or the pasta, the tomato sauce. You might even know how to walk or drive there on autopilot. But what would you do if you got to your local supermarket and there was a picket line out front?
I don't know why they're doing this, why they would be boycotting, but I'm sure they've got a good reason. I would definitely not walk in.
That's what happened back in 2003 when there was a massive grocery worker strike that went on for close to 5 months, right through the holidays. About 70,000 workers were on strike all across Southern California. It included hundreds of stores, Albertsons, Vons, Ralphs, Pavilions. And it could happen again as soon as this week. Workers at those same four Southern California supermarket chains have voted with their union, the United Food and Commercial Workers International, to authorize a strike. That means close to 50,000 of those folks could be on strike as early as this weekend, with negotiations scheduled until July 12th. Joining me now to talk about it is reporter Carla Green, who spoke to some shoppers at Ralph's in Palm Springs. Hey, Carla.
Hi, Steve.
So paint us a picture, if you will. How are things looking out there?
So this Ralph's is a pretty typical Ralph's. Everything is in the exact same place as it is in the Ralph's that I go to in Los Angeles. The place wasn't packed, but there were a fair number of people who were there, you know, picking up beer, barbecue supplies for the holidays. I talked to this one guy who was standing near the freezer section, and he was pretty sympathetic to the workers.
I understand why people strike. It's hard, but I hope it doesn't work out that way. I hope they are able to work out the disagreements, but sometimes measures have to be taken just to at least get your voice heard.
I talked to a handful of other people at the grocery store that day. Pretty much everyone was hoping that the grocery workers would not have to go on strike. And the workers also hope that they don't have to go on strike.
What is this all about, Carla? Why are the workers maybe going to strike?
Well, they have a series of demands. They want more than 1% wage increases. They're hoping for better health coverage. They're also hoping for a better pension. I talked to one worker who was out there on the picket lines back in 2003, the last time that they went on strike. She was actually a picket captain. Her name is Kathy Moore, and she's worked at Vons for over 40 years. She's now a shop steward at the store in Eagle Rock. And Kathy actually retired and then came back to work 40 hours a month because the pension wasn't enough to live off of.
Last time I was out there 12 hours a day, 5 days a week. I don't think anyone really knew what was going to happen and that it was going to take that long to resolve. Most of us thought that we'd be out for a month, you know, and that, you know, they would go back to the table and talk and things would get ironed out. We had no idea that it was going to take that long.
And Kathy says that because of her experience back in 2003, she's dreading the prospect of another strike.
It was quite difficult for people. As it dragged on, people were losing their homes. People were losing their cars. People were in dire straits. We had a great support from the community. People were bringing by food and water, were bringing by gift cards for Target, for other union grocery stores so that people would just get by. We were having Thanksgiving dinners on the line. We were having Christmas dinners on the line because we went through the holidays too. People didn't have any money for gifts for their kids. You know, people were bringing their kids out to the line to walk the line because of that. But we had the greatest support from our customers.
It sounds to me like it was really hard, Carla, for the workers. Must have felt like it was worthwhile then if they're thinking about striking again after going through all of that?
Yeah, I asked Kathy that exact question, actually, if she felt like it was worth it. Yeah.
Because if you had seen the proposal that they were giving us at the time, there was no way we could go that far backward. There was no way we could step back that far.
So they did eventually reach a deal back in 2003. But they were on strike for a long time, 4.5 months. There was apparently a lot of consumer support, but then there were wildfires that broke out, and then lots of people kind of went shopping despite the boycott to go get emergency supplies. And when they finally did reach a deal, the union did not get everything that they wanted. One less than ideal thing for the union and the workers that resulted from those negotiations was this two-tier system between people who already worked at the stores before the strike and after. There's actually now a different but still two-tier system where food prep workers, like deli workers or people who work in the bakery or butcher shop, they have a lower ceiling for wages than other workers, like people who work in the produce section. And according to the union, those food prep workers are, for the most part, women, many of them women of color. I spoke to one of those workers. Her name is Carla Barrera. She spoke at a union press conference.
Okay, we're live.
We do provide the food for many of you guys when you guys are too lazy to do it. And with pleasure, I'd love to do that. But there's one thing, hours are cut, the pay is not fair, there's no help.
So Carla has worked at Ralph's for about 5 years. She moved here from El Salvador when she was 10. She's 27 years old now. She's got two kids. She's a single mom, and she's actually a manager. And she said actually that her workers will get anxious when a new person gets hired, because even though they really need the help, it means that the existing workers are going to get fewer hours.
Why is it the baker and service deli gets to pay the less? Is it because it's a woman's job? I mean, honestly, I feel like we women do a pretty good job, and we should be. It should be fair. It should be a fair pay. We work as hard as every other department does.
And then Carla said that even for herself as a manager, the pay that she gets as a manager, it's still hard for her to live on it.
I have two kids that I have to take care of. I'm a single mom. I mean, whatever I bring home is what pays the bills. And it's not right for them to do what they're doing.
So how likely is it that they're going to strike?
Well, that is hard to know. They do have a lot of support from their members to strike if they feel like they have to. 96% of the people who voted to authorize the strike. And last week, the union and the AFL-CIO, the American Federation of Labor, they announced that other union members would support the UFCW members if they do go on strike. The biggest deal out of this announcement is that Teamsters, for example, wouldn't drive to or from the supermarkets, wouldn't, you know, make deliveries, pick up trash. It also means that any union members would respect a boycott if there was one. And so they're promising not to shop at those stores, not cross the picket line. The fact that they have the strike authorization does not necessarily mean that they're going to strike. I talked to the local union president, a guy named John Grant, and he said that he was hoping the authorization alone might pressure the companies into reaching a deal with the union. And when I talked to John Grant at the union's office, he pulled out this tagline to explain like what they're fighting for. And the tagline is, one job should be enough, which is the idea that you should be able to live off the wages of one job alone.
As we say, that one job should be enough in every sense of the word, one job should be enough that you wouldn't have to have two or three jobs. We're looking for more than just dollars on wages and secure pension, though that is central. That's not even a bargaining point. That's the floor with which we stand, and we don't even assume that the floor is going to move. The question is, how much higher can we go?
Do we think, Carla, that the companies are going to make a deal with these workers?
It's hard to know if the companies are going to make a deal. But in terms of Grant's strategy, to a certain extent, he's counting on the companies being financially vulnerable right now. Things are different than they were back in 2003. People do a lot of shopping online. There are also a lot of different options where consumers can go. If there's a boycott and a picket line outside of the Ralphs or Vons, people can go to Trader Joe's or Whole Foods or Target. And so there's the possibility that a boycott and a strike could really hurt the company's bottom lines financially.
We don't believe that they can or should withstand loss of sales, because in the grocery industry, as opposed to a gas station, people develop habits and a familiarity with stores and the personnel inside of it. And once you develop that habit where you can almost walk through the store on autopilot until you find your favorite clerk to talk to, once that pattern is broken, people don't go back. And that's happened in the 03-04.
And that's true. People did change their buying habits back in 2003 and 2004. Overall, there was reportedly $1.5 billion in lost sales after the strike.
And a lot of consolidation, obviously, in the companies, too, because we know Albertsons bought Safeway, which owns Vons and Pavilions, and Kroger bought Ralph's. And so you've got this consolidation happening. You have the companies probably very much worried about what could happen. Did you talk to those companies? Did they say anything to you about the story?
Well, I reached out to Albertsons and Kroger. Neither company would talk to me. Albertsons management sent over an emailed statement saying that they are focused on the negotiations. And then they said, quote, "Our goal is a contract that benefits the employees, the companies, and the customers." Kroger didn't even respond to my request for comment.
And what about people like Carla Barrera, who weren't around for the last strike? How are they feeling about all this? They don't remember what happened, right?
Yeah, I asked Carla that question.
Are you nervous about the possibility of a strike?
Yes, I am definitely nervous, scared, because like I said, I do have two kids to take care of. But if we don't stand for what we believe it's right for us, then they're always going to just keep stepping all over us, and it's not right.
Carla Barrera, an employee of one of those grocery stores. We're going to know more once they finish this round of negotiations toward the end of this week and keep you posted on this program. Reporter Carla Green. Carla, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Well, from the demands of grocery store employees to the demands of gig economy workers, those are the folks who drive you around in a Lyft or Uber, or the people who bring food to your door through Postmates or DoorDash. Those workers get the freedom to control their own hours, but they don't receive the other things that you get with full-time work, such as health insurance, workers' compensation, or even paid leave. Some like it that way, by the way. Others do not. And in Sacramento, the drivers who want to remain independent contractors are protesting a state assembly bill that heads to a Senate hearing today. And here to fill us in on the bill and what it could mean for gig workers, Kent Wong heads up the UCLA Labor Center. Hey, Kent.
Hi, Steve.
Break this down for us. What is Assembly Bill 5 all about?
Assembly Bill 5 would enact sweeping changes with regard to how Uber and Lyft and other gig economy workers are characterized, and currently they are considered independent contractors, and AB 5 would make it much easier for these group of workers to be classified as employees. This would have a huge impact on thousands and thousands of Uber and Lyft drivers throughout the state of California who would be eligible for unemployment insurance, overtime pay, workers' compensation, and a guaranteed minimum wage.
Now, this bill is authored by Assemblywoman Lorena Gonzalez. Has she said why she put this out in the first place?
Lorena Gonzalez has been a longtime workers' advocate here in the state of California. She used to be head of the San Diego Labor Council, so she's very familiar with these issues. Many large corporations are skirting the laws by mischaracterizing their workers as independent contractors, so they don't have to cover the needs of their employees. So the UCLA Labor Center conducted the very first study of Uber and Lyft drivers from Los Angeles County. And it was very interesting to discover that while Uber and Lyft drivers very much enjoy the flexibility of being able to set their own days and hours, they don't like a lot of the provisions that are imposed upon them because of their independent contractor status. And they would very much like to have more of the protections that most workers in the California economy are provided.
But some people worry that becoming a full-time employee would mean giving up the flexibility that they have right now, that flexibility that we talk about. And some people actually say that could hurt minority groups. This is Pastor William Smart, who heads up the Southern Christian Conference of Southern California. He had a press conference earlier this week to oppose AB 5, saying it would hinder earning potential of black drivers.
It's important for workers to be in companies, but in this industry, in rideshare, it just simply does not work. They need to remain independent contractors. A striking 97% of African-American drivers in California say being able to maintain a flexible schedule is important to them.
All right, so you hear that, Kent Wong. What would you say to that?
Well, it's not actually an either-or situation. The corporation still could maintain a flexible work schedule, as many employers do, to allow their workers to select their days of the week and their hours each day. So that could still be built into the equation. The main thing that the drivers are asking for is the worker protections that are afforded millions of other California workers and that they are currently being denied.
Who else does this affect besides the drivers, the people who drive you around or the people who bring you food through Postmates and the like?
Well, as I said, the term independent contractor has been significantly expanded over the years. There has been a major battle at the Port of Los Angeles and other ports across the country over the characterization of truck drivers as independent contractors. There has been a lot of use of independent contractors in the construction industry. There has been use of independent contractors even in farm labor under different circumstances. So in each of these situations, in particular those dealing with low-wage workers, there's tremendous benefit of corporations and employers from using the independent contractor term.
Is there any benefit to the employee besides the flexibility that they have? As you say, you can have both.
Well, for certain true independent contractors, that is the correct characterization. And so for lawyers, for accountants, for architects, for doctors, the term independent contractor is absolutely appropriate. They run their own businesses. They have their own offices. They set their own schedules and they perform work as an independent contractor. That's a completely appropriate characterization for those groups of workers. When you're talking about Uber and Lyft drivers, the reality is that they have very little control and very little say over their work environment, but for the fact that they do get to select their own days and hours.
What do these companies say, Uber and Lyft and Postmates and these other folks that have these independent contractors? Are they fighting back?
Uber and Lyft are investing large amounts of money to conduct a lobbying campaign to try to block the characterization of their workers as employees. And there's tremendous profit incentive for them to try to mobilize opposition to AB 5. And there's also a very aggressive campaign currently to reach out to some of the Uber and Lyft drivers who may be pleased with the current situation.
And do you think it'll pass in Sacramento?
Given the current political makeup of the California state legislature, I think that AB 5 has a very good chance of prevailing.
Kent Wong, who heads up the UCLA Labor Center. Kent, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, just ahead, art that incorporates different kinds of media while focusing on the human body. A couple of artists tackle art that looks at the female anatomy, but can you call it feminist art? That's yours on Greater LA. By the way, check us out online at kcrw.com/GreaterLA or by podcast, wherever you get those podcasts. Back with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. A couple of artists are taking to the exhibit floor here in Los Angeles with their works that mostly highlight the female body. British artist Sarah Lucas has a big retrospective titled Al Natural going on at the Hammer. And Donna Huanca, who's based in Berlin, has a show called Obsidian Ladder at the Marciano Art Foundation. Now, each one has a very different approach to her work. Lindsay Preston Zappas has been to both shows. She's the founder and editor-in-chief of Carla, or Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi, Steve.
Sarah Lucas, tell us about her and her work and what you'll see when you go to the Hammer.
Yeah, so Sarah Lucas is a British artist, as you said. She kind of came up in the 90s with a group called the YBAs, or Young British Artists. So if you know Damien Hirst, is kind of along with that group. And her work is super direct and bold and centers around ideas of gender and sexuality. You often hear her described as kind of punk rock or confrontational. And her work definitely has a very defiant and kind of gritty energy to it. And a lot of the sculptural work uses everyday objects. So you might see eggs or fruits and vegetables,
eggs.
Toilets, things like this that kind of allude to anatomy or gender kind of on the body.
When you say bold, I mean, are you stopping short of shocking? Is there shock value in that too?
I think at the time it was made in the 90s, her work definitely had a kind of brash shock value to it.
You mentioned eggs.
Yes.
And one of her pieces involves a couple of fried eggs and a pita pocket with meat.
Yeah.
Now, I'm trying to envision this.
Yeah. So this piece that you're referring to is called Two Fried Eggs and a Kebab. And it's a super well-known work of hers and very emblematic of what she does. So the work is a wooden table, and just on it are two fried eggs and a kebab that are meant to kind of be stand-ins for the female body. So the table in this case becomes the base of the body, and the eggs become the breasts and the kebab. Maybe you can infer.
Is all this food like just laying around like it's for day? Because that could get messy, right?
Yeah. Or... So actually there's someone at the Hammer who has to fry these eggs every day and replace them on the table. I watched a video. It has to be the perfect fried egg in order to evoke female breasts, basically. And so it's a very kind of particular notion. But I think it's really interesting that with these really simple stand-ins for the body, it's kind of one-to-one in a way, but also a bit shocking as well. And then she makes this person almost become a slave to the artwork and kind of service this rendering of the female body every day.
That's
so it's an interesting power dynamic that's kind of embedded in the piece.
And the curator also serves as a short order cook.
yeah.
What about Donna Huanca? How would you describe what she does? I'd imagine the Berlin art scene is a little different from LA's.
Yeah, so Donna Huanca's work, again, works across mediums. So she does sculpture, performance, painting as well, and also scent. She uses perfumes and scents in her work and sound as well. But a big element in her work is live performers, often female. And these performers are nude or partially nude, but they become as kind of ornamented as the sculptures. So she uses body paint and natural materials like clay to kind of paint these bodies. And then they inhabit the installation. So at the Marciano, she's created this almost sci-fi type landscape that once a week, these performers on Saturdays, you can go and see, they sort of inhabit the space and move slowly and meditatively throughout.
Are these two women, are they... different in a generational kind of way? I mean, what are their ages? Are they close in age?
Totally, yeah. So Sarah Lucas was born in the 60s. And as I said, she kind of came up in the 90s. And Donna Huanca is born in the 80s. And very much, you know, I think both their work really responds to the gender issues of their time. At the time it was made in the 90s, Sarah Lucas's work was, as we discussed, like kind of shocking and really made a statement. But in a way, she's very much emulating male behavior. You see her kind of taking on the postures and kind of behavior of men in order to make a statement about the norms of female behavior and gender. Whereas Donna, I think, represents more of kind of the current or future perspective on gender. You know, she uses transgender performers in her work as well. So I think for her, gender is a much more fluid spectrum, which so much relates to kind of a feminist conversation today.
When we're talking about feminism, not necessarily with these two, but when we're talking about it, do you think feminism has evolved? And how has it evolved in the work of women artists just in the last few decades?
Yeah, huge question, Steve. So I'll kind of shift that a little bit and maybe just talk about how we're looking at these two artists today. So, you know, as I said, Sarah Lucas, at the time it was made a really big impact. But there's been a few articles in response to the Hammer show, and actually one coming out in my publication, Carla, that kind of wonders if Sarah, if her work doesn't quite stand up in the era of Me Too, like maybe it's looking at gender in too much of a polar kind of simple way.
Mm.
Whereas Donna is imagining a future that might be sort of post-patriarchy and not so much on that male-female spectrum. And I think now we're really wanting artists to sort of invent new structures and respond to the complexity of our current time.
Well, Sarah Lucas's big retrospective is titled Au Naturel. It goes on at the Hammer Museum. Donna Huanca has a show called Obsidian Ladder over at the Marciano Art Foundation. And Lindsay Preston-Zappas, founder and editor-in-chief of Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles, or Carla. Lindsay, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Well, that's it for today. Tomorrow, I hope you're hungry. Eggs, kebabs? No. For some, South LA eats a lot of flavor, personality too, a dash of social media appeal. It's all under one roof, and it opens this weekend. We're going to get you in the door first, though, tomorrow on Greater LA. Coming up next on KCRW, All the President's Lawyers. Our producer is Catherine Barnes. Our editor, Sonia Geis. Phil Richards and Ray Guarna. Engineer and mix the show, Christian Bordahl. Well, he lassos everyone together here for this program each and every day. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Always online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. You can check out the podcast wherever you get your podcast. I'm on Twitter at Radio Chio. It's been an honor, as usual. Thanks for your time, for your ear. Have a great day.